Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And just a note regarding this next segment, it may not be appropriate for all listeners because we're going to spend about 20 minutes or so talking about sex, specifically women and sex. And joining us to do so is Emily Nagoski. She's the director of wellness education at Smith College, and she teaches a course on women's sexuality. And on the final exam in this course, Emily always asks her students what the most important thing they learned in class was. And Emily, what do the majority of your students say?
They say, "I'm normal."
That was the most important thing they learned.
Yeah. After a semester in which I have shoehorned in as much of the most cutting-edge science as I can, what they get out of all that is, it turns out just because my sexuality is not what I thought it was supposed to be, I'm not actually broken. I'm normal.
Now, why is that so important, that that's the key lesson that all these women who take your class have learned?
There's a lot of reasons that it's important for women to feel normal. But the main reason is that feeling normal is a gateway into having an actual healthy sex life. Because when you're busy criticizing yourself, does that make things better or less good?
Yeah. I suppose another reason, just to state the obvious, and every woman out there listening is going to be like, no, duh, Meghna, is that so many women feel like there's something wrong, whether it's with their body, with their desire, with their reactions, when it comes to sex and sexuality. I mean, it might be too easy to say this, but that most women feel this way?
To an amazing extent. And I think a reason that's the case is that we're taught from the very beginning in our culture a model of sexual response that is based entirely on how men work. And so the extent to which women fail to be like men is the extent to which they fail to be sexually normal. And that's just not true.
Okay, so hold that thought for just a minute, because I should tell listeners that along with you being the director of wellness education at Smith College, you do have this new book out called Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. And it is quite a read, and I'm glad that we're able to talk about it on Radio Boston here today. So, Emily, let me first ask you to pick up where you left off, that I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, because the history of medicine has tended to do this. It's basically treating women as men light and trying to sort of transpose the science of one onto the other. But why does this matter specifically when it comes to sex and sexuality?
Since about 1999, we've had a medication to treat the most common male sexual dysfunction. And so we've spent the last, 15 years looking for a female equivalent.
So you're talking about the little blue pill.
Right, the little blue pill. And now, so where, the big question is, where's the little pink pill? Where's the one for women? And so the last 15 years, there's been this explosion of research on women's sexual well-being, more than in the 20 years before that. And what that research has told us in the search for the pink pill is that there's probably never going to be a pink pill. And so why?
Let me ask you, because Viagra, the little blue pill, whatever its scientific name is designed to treat the problem of male erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that scientists, researchers have been looking for something that would treat the analogous dysfunction in women? If so, what is that dysfunction?
That is exactly the problem, because the PDE5 inhibitors, which is what that class of drug is, increases blood flow to male genitals, and it does exactly the same thing to female genitals. Unfortunately, while there's about a 50% overlap between male genital response and how aroused he feels, for women, there's about a 10% overlap between blood flow to the genitals and how turned on she feels. So you can increase blood flow, and it will not necessarily influence how aroused she feels.
Mm. And so why all the focus then on trying to find this little pink pill?
So
other than the money.
Which is really like the big focus. But right. A lot of women are struggling around, in particular, the question not of arousal, but desire for sex. One of the things that we're taught in the standard model of sexual response is that desire is spontaneous. It should just happen out of the blue. Walking down the street, you have a stray thought and you think to yourself, I would really like to go make some sex happen tonight. What can I do to make that happen? That's spontaneous desire. And it's totally a normal, healthy, natural way to experience desire. But it turns out there's also this second way to experience desire called responsive desire. And in the last 15 years in particular, we've gotten a lot of research showing that if you're sort of in neutral, just reading a magazine, and your partner starts kissing your neck and caressing your arm, and all your body goes, oh, that's a really good idea. That's responsive desire, right? The arousal comes first and then desire. That's responsive desire, and it is also normal.
Huh. So, I mean, one of the core messages in your book is that women are all made of the same basic parts. Our anatomies might look a little different or vastly different, but the structures are all basically the same, organized in different ways. No one person's is better than any others. The sources of desire are different, sensitivities are different, etc. It's all normal. Does that mean then that there's no such thing really as female sexual dysfunction?
So the standards for me for healthy, normal sex are consent, lack of unwanted pain, and satisfaction. When all three of those things are there, you're doing really well. Satisfaction's complicated, though, because that's based on I have an expectation of what it should be like, and I either do or don't match that expectation. And if your expectations are based on incorrect information, then you're going to be dissatisfied, not for medical reasons, but because your expectation doesn't make sense for who your body actually is.
So in the book, you basically repeatedly say in some form or another in every chapter, understand yourself.
Yes.
Understand what makes your normal normal for you.
Yes. Yes. Over and over again, in the course of my training as a sex educator and in talking with women, I have learned over and over that the best source of wisdom for a woman about her sexual well-being is her own internal experience, trusting your body more than you trust other people's opinions about your body.
All right, listeners, we're speaking with Emily Nagoski. She's Director of Wellness Education at Smith College. Her new book is Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. And as you heard, we were just talking about the idea, the concept, the construct even, of female sexual dysfunction. And we wonder if any of this rings true to you. Have you ever felt that something was wrong with you? And if so, what did you do about it, if anything? Where do you think you got that message that something might be wrong with you? And what's your reaction to some of the ideas and the science, which we'll get into in more detail, that Nagoski presents, that regardless of anatomy, context, or personal history, you are sexually normal? And I'm also wondering for the men listening out there, what's your reaction to all this? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So Emily, you separate you separate your chapters into chapters that talk about the body, chapters that talk about the brain, and chapters that talk about context, which I found really, really interesting. We'll get to that. But regarding the body, you write that one of the biggest barriers of understanding for women and their sexuality has to do with not even really knowing their own bodies, which in 2015, that might have been in 2015, it's kind of jarring to hear that because it might have held even more true back when, you know, our bodies ourselves was still like a new concept. But you say not much has really changed.
Amazingly little has changed. Students walk into my class feeling very sophisticated, like they know a whole lot about sex. And what they know a lot about is what their culture has taught them about sex. And they know a lot about it. And that, it turns out, has really very little relationship to what the science says about sex. So halfway through my first lecture, which is about anatomy, they're sitting there with their jaws in their lap, having had their minds blown about, like, how big the clitoris actually is and what's the deal with the hymen, things they really thought they knew that it turns out, no.
That surprises me. I mean, I'm in my late 30s now, and I'm thinking to myself that teens and 20-somethings have grown up, not all of them, because it really varies from school to school, but at least, like, you know, the idea of basic sex education, you know, seems to be, it shouldn't be so basic anymore.
You would think not. I actually, one of the things I do in my class is read the definition of normal sex from the Height Report, which was written in the 70s, and the definition of normal sex from Ideal Marriage, which was written in the 20s. and I ask them which definition sounds more like the one they grew up with. And easily, hands down, it's the 90-year-old definition of, like, good old heterosexual intercourse with simultaneous orgasm only for purposes of procreation.
Why? Why is that idea so powerful and enduring?
The policing, in particular, of everyone's body and everyone's sexuality, but women's, from a biological point of view, the imperative there, who controls sex, controls the genetic destiny of our species. It's a big deal. Sex is important, and there's a lot of rules that every society has. The rules are different in every society, but every society lays down a lot of rules about what sex is okay and what sex is not.
You know, and let's be honest, it's difficult even to this day to have honest conversations about sex and sexuality. And that may be one of the reasons why when we do talk about it, it tends to get oversimplified. I mean, you talk about in the book about how people think about their own libidos, that it's kind of like binary, it's either high or low, right? Which isn't true.
No, desire for sex is very sensitive to context. There are some situations, and if anybody thinks back about their own sexual history, you'll be able to identify certain periods of your life when you had a really high interest in sex compared to other periods, and sometimes when it was really not so much in place. Some people are more consistent and stable across their lifespan, but for most people, it really changes a lot.
Yeah. So take us into a little more now of what the science says, for example, about libido and, I guess, female libido, because you do talk in the book about the existence of sexual accelerators and sexual breaks. Tell us more about that.
So this is the dual control model of sexual response, which was developed in the late 90s at the Kinsey Institute. And it says, well, it's the dual control model, so there's two parts to it. And one part is the gas pedal or accelerator, which means the other part has to be the brake. So the accelerator responds to all the sexually relevant information in the environment, everything you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or imagine that your brain codes as sexually relevant, and it sends the turn on signal. The brake, at the same time that that's happening, is noticing all the very good reasons not to be turned on right now. Everything you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or imagine, that's a potential threat. And it sends a signal that says turn off. So arousal is not just the process of turning on the ons. It's also turning off the offs.
Are we in conscious control of the accelerator and the brake?
Mostly not.
Mostly not.
So we
can't change our sensitivities to either of them?
We can. So it's happening at a low level in everyone's brain right now while they're listening to this. And the brakes are probably doing a really good job of knowing whether or not now is an appropriate time to be aroused. You're in public or whatever, you're not sure you trust the people around you, all kinds of good reasons. But if your brakes responds to, so for women, body self-criticism is a really big hitter of the brakes. It's not so much that you can train your brake not to respond to body self-criticism, but you can train yourself not to criticize your body during the process of sexual arousal.
It sounds like what you're saying is that at least in terms of the accelerators and brakes, if training is possible, then are these accelerators and brakes initially formed through experience and learning and just
what they're so there's a normal bell curve distribution of how sensitive the accelerator and the brakes are. Most of us are just heaped up in the average section. There are some people with extra sensitive or insensitive accelerators and extra sensitive or not sensitive brakes. Most of us are just average. And from the moment we're born, our brains are learning what to count as sexually relevant and what to count as a potential threat. And that's what we can change. It's learned. There's almost nothing that's actually innately sexual. So we learn that, and we can unlearn it and teach it something new.
Yeah. We just got a tweet from Tildy Banker Johnson, who is asking me, Meghna, please note that you're referring to cis women, not all women. Are you referring to everyone who identifies as women or female, you know, regardless of actual anatomy in the book?
The research is hugely erasing of trans women and everyone outside the gender binary. So there's actually a caveat in the introduction of the book that because the research is almost exclusively on cisgender people, it's really a book about cis women. I think over the next 10 years, we're going to get research that looks at the trans community and at genderqueer people, and shows us that everything is really exactly the same for them as it is for everybody else. But because the research is so exclusively about cis people, that's all I can talk about in terms of the research.
All right. We're talking with Emily Nagoski. She's author of the new book, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from the South End. You're on the air, Sarah.
Yes, hi. I would love to hear her talk a little bit about sex, pain with sex or vaginismus, because there's really not a lot of conversation about it. You see commercials for pain with sex, but it's really relegated to women who are going through menopause. But there's a population of women who experience chronic pain with sex, and there's therapy that goes on, but no one ever talks about it. It does greatly impact libido and relationships.
Sarah, thanks so much for your call. Emily, your response.
Yeah, vaginismus is one of the most treatable forms of sexual pain. So a brief definition, vaginismus is chronic inhibitory tone of the pubococcygeal muscle. So the muscle at the mouth of the genitals is locked up tight. And the treatment is a combination of systematic desensitization meditation, essentially, where you learn to tighten and relax that muscle at will. So you gradually learn to relax it when you want it to be, and it can be a source of very intense pain. A lot of couples will get to the point of being married, and it's not until they want to have kids that they seek treatment, because women can be fully functional sexually otherwise, but just not be able to experience penetration. So it's highly treatable. When women bring reports of genital pain to their doctors, much too often the doctors are dismissive and say that it's all in your head. So if that happens to you when you go to a doctor, find a different doctor. There are some great books about pain, and we know for sure that there are effective treatments, not just for genital pain associated with the dryness of menopause, for example, but also for dyspareunia and for vulvodynia. Effective treatments exist.
Listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston with your questions for Emily Nagoski, author of the new book, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. Emily, just a minute ago, we were talking about accelerators and brakes when it comes to desire. And throughout the book, you actually have little vignettes of not necessarily real women, but sort of stories, mm-hmm. That echo stories that you've heard from many women. And there's just one in particular that I wanted to read, because it talks a lot about, I think in my mind it encapsulates a lot of the stresses and pressures that women face in life. So this is about a person you'll fictionally called Lori. And you write, "We wrote a list of the things that activate her brakes. Kids, full-time job with a rotten boss, her parents, not to mention the way her body had changed since her pregnancy, which made her unhappy, and she also felt unhappy about feeling unhappy since the feminist in her made her judge herself for not being able to let go of the arbitrary cultural ideal and just love her body. Oh, and also, she was going back to school for a master's degree, so no big deal." This one hit home for me in particular, but I think it was just this idea that there are so many forces around women that just cause stress at all levels that can change people's concept about how they feel about themselves and sex.
Yes, and add to that the fact that, so the next thing that happened in that conversation in real life was that she said, "Just looking at this list makes me need a massage." So I said, "How about you ask your partner for a massage?" And she said, "Great, then I'll feel guilty about not having sex after that." So we have all these stressors, and then on top of that, we have the expectation that despite these stressors, we should be sexual dynamos, and then we're not, which just adds another layer of stress on top of it.
Yeah, but if these contexts, cultural and personal and historical, are so powerful when it comes to, you know, providing inputs into the brain, the most sexual of all organs, it seems like, I mean, those contexts are very difficult to change. It's got to be more than just like, okay, well, ask your partner for a massage.
It's actually, I have found people are pretty good at changing their context, because once it's you and your partner alone together in the room where you want to connect, the two of you are allowed to do anything that both of you want to do. And when you know that you have permission to let go of the rules and you know that all the stuff you've been taught to expect, not necessarily going to be right. People are amazingly good at learning to trust their bodies and experience the pleasure that's happening between them and their partner and inside their body as soon as they're given permission.
Let's take another call. Meredith is calling from Medway. You're on the air, Meredith.
Hi. I missed the beginning, so I'm not sure if I'm bringing up a redundant point, but I'm excited to hear about this kind of research and bringing context and the uniqueness of the individual and female sexuality into the discussion about performance. I mean, in many ways, the sexual revolution, although it was great, I mean, I'm in my 60s, so I've kind of like been there for the whole thing, also placed a burden on women to be sort of as sexually active on a dime as men are, you know, throughout the course, certainly, of my lifetime. Now, as the boomers are aging into old age, Viagra and other performance-enhancing drugs for men, which have, and also things like testosterone and HGH, all the things that make them have more desire and have more, you know, terrific performance, happen just as women are going through menopause, are experiencing a lot of the emotional and hormonal upheavals of menopause. They're experiencing, you know, dryness, reduced libido, physical changes, et cetera. And there's been very little focus on actually, I think it's been irresponsible of doctors to just start prescribing this stuff to men without trying to insist on a discussion with partners, really bringing up many of the issues that she brings up.
Meredith, I'm sorry to jump in here. Forgive me for interrupting you, but we literally just have a couple minutes to go, and I wanted to give Emily a chance to, she's shaking her head in agreement here. I wanted to give her a chance to respond.
I think one of the most interesting areas of research around the drugs for men is actually the influence that these drugs have on relationships. Because if there's a relationship where erections haven't been there and now they suddenly are, how does the partner feel about that? A female partner may have actually felt more satisfied in a relationship where the focus wasn't so much on intercourse and so much on there being an erection involved. And so you could be free to do other things, engage in sexuality in other ways. And it has turned out that for some couples, increasing sexual functioning, as medically defined, has actually reduced sexual satisfaction. So there is research that's happening about that.
You know, we could talk so very much about all the ideas that you present in your book, but we've just got a minute to go. And I wanted to end with this question. In the intro to your book, you write that despite our culture's vested interest in making us feel broken, dysfunctional, unlovely, and unlovable, we are in fact fully capable of confident, joyful sex. For women out there who are hearing this and just saying, I just don't feel that way, what could you say that might help them take a step closer to feeling that way?
I think our culture gives us a good sort of dialogue about how much we want sex or not, and how much we have sex or not, and what we do, but it doesn't really create a space for us to talk about how much we like sex and whether or not we enjoy what we're doing. The place to start is with pleasure, what's happening inside your body and enjoying the sex you're having.
Well, Emily Nagoski is the director of wellness education at Smith College and author of the new book, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. She's speaking tonight at Wellesley College. There's more information about that at radioboston.org. Emily Nagoski, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, stick with us. There's more of Radio Boston in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.